15. Sergeant Fukida was in no mood to be trifled with. His annual mock orange pollen allergy attack, late this year, had finally caught up with him as he'd gotten home from work the previous day, smiting him with itchy, runny eyes, headache, sinus congestion, achy joints, and all-around misery. With Chiyoko staying at their daughter's on Oahu overnight, he'd had to fend for himself, which meant not only an absence of much-needed wifely care and sympathy, but a pathetic, solitary dinner of scrambled eggs over rice, representing the extreme limit of his culinary virtuosity. He'd taken a couple of allergy tablets at 8 and gone to bed, another 2 at midnight, and 2 more at 3 a.m. when a stuffed nose had strangled him out of sleep. He'd awakened to the alarm at 7 with a vicious antihistamine hangover and nasal passages that felt as if they'd been cleaned out with a paint scraper. Headachy, dull-brained, and generally mad at the world, he'd driven to work on a breakfast of microwave-warmed, leftover scrambled eggs and rice and 3 cups of tea. His plan was to tell Sarah, "No visitors, no phone calls," to barricade himself in his cubicle and to spend the day on paperwork, of which he had plenty to catch up on, sleeping through lunch if at all possible. This was not a day on which he should be expected to deal with living, speaking human beings. Fortunately, there were no appointments or meetings on his calendar. His plan did not work.
"Morning, Sarge. Couple of ladies waiting in there to see you," was Sarah's gratingly cheery greeting. "They were sitting in the lobby when I got here."
He stifled a groan. "To see me in particular or anybody?" he asked, but without any real hope.
"Sorry," Sarah said with a grin. "To see you. I checked with the lieutenant, and he said it's you, all right."
"You know what it's about?"
"The Torkelson thing?"
"I knew I shouldn't have come to work," he said bitterly. "My head is in no condition to deal with the Torkelson thing."
"Do you want me to—"
"No," he said, drawing himself up and looking for the first time into the opening to his cubicle. He could just see a pair of black pant-clad legs, the feet of which barely touched the floor. "I'll deal with it."
"Brave sergeant," Sarah said. "Good sergeant."
He disliked them right off the bat. The old woman sat as if she owned the place, barely turning her head to cast a beady, disapproving eye on him as he entered his own office. The younger one, in jeans and western shirt, sprawled in his other visitor's chair like a man, legs akimbo, one booted ankle on the other knee. He didn't much care for that either.
"We've been waiting some time," the old woman told him.
"Tough." He squeezed around the desk, took his seat, and looked at them inquiringly, his expression neutral.
"I am Dagmar Torkelson," the old lady said. "This is my niece, Inga Torkelson Nakoa. Do you know who we are?"
"Yes. What can I do for you?"
"You are familiar with the Torkelson matter of some years ago?"
Fukida nodded.
"Excellent. We are here to correct certain misapprehensions that the police may have in regard to those events."
You are here, Fukida thought, because Lau and Oliver had gone about their discreet inquiries like a couple of bulls in a china shop, rattling the teeth of the entire Torkelson establishment. They were now aware that the lies they had told 10 years ago had caught up with them, and unless he was mistaken, he was about to hear some bogus, newly concocted version of events that would supposedly explain away the old contradictions and ambiguities. A little more fancy dancing by the doyen of the clan to once again boggle the minds of the credible, gullible Hawaii County PD. Well, let him try. Irritable as he was genuinely curious to see what they'd come up with. His headache, he found, had receded. He rearranged himself more comfortably in his chair and pulled a pad and pen to within easy reach. "Misapprehensions," he said. The niece, Inga, spoke for the first time, doing her best to look helpful and remorseful.
"You see, we weren't entirely truthful before."
"No. Really?" he thought, but didn't say.
In what way would that be, Mrs. Nakoa?
After the briefest of glances between the two women, it was Dagmar who picked up the ball.
The fact is that we, all of us, have been aware from the beginning that the body in the hay barn was not that of my brother, Torkel.
He tried not to show his surprise, but an outright, unforced admission of this central, critical fact was not what he'd been expecting. What game were they playing? He felt himself suddenly off balance. His headache stabbed at him again.
You were...
Young man, Dagmar said harshly, will you kindly stop that wiggling? It makes it difficult to concentrate.
Wiggling?
She made a series of irritated gestures toward the ballpoint pen that he was inarguably clicking open and shut, toward his tapping foot, toward the base of his chair, which creaked with every little bobbing movement of his body. Angrily, he made himself be still. But who the hell did this old... It was time, he decided, to retake the initiative.
Do you happen to be aware of who chopped off two of his toes to make us think he was Torkel? He asked brutally.
Yes, Inga responded. That was me.
That was you, Fukita repeated stupidly, mostly because he couldn't think of anything else to say. Was he supposed to believe her? What were these two up to? Damn those allergy pills. The inside of his skull felt as if it were crammed with cotton balls. He went on. You cut off the toes. And what did you use to do that?
She replied without hesitation.
I used a Swiss garlic chopper, a sort of tiny little cleaver, and a paperweight. It was the business end of an old branding iron, as a mallet to drive it through.
She held an imaginary handle in one hand, pretending to tap it with an object in her other hand. It has to be true, Fukita thought. Who could make up something like that? A Swiss garlic chopper, for Christ's sake.
I think we better get this on the record, he said. Let's go someplace a little more comfortable.
Happily unaware of what had been unfolding at the police department, Julie, Gideon, and John spent Monday morning acting on their decision of the day before. As Julie had promised, the previous evening she had extricated them from their awkward position at Axel's and Milani's, without seriously raising anybody's hackles. And early today they had checked in at the Waikoloa Outrigger, left their bags with the concierge, and breakfasted at the poolside grill with a guilty but welcome sense of freedom. Then they had rented a Ford Taurus and driven down the South Kona coast to visit a few of John's favorite places, the hidden-away black sand beach at Ho'okena, the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay, the evocative and beautiful Puohunua Ohunuanua, the place of refuge historical park, a city of stone where ancients who had broken laws against gods or kings, who were much the same, could find sanctuary and avoid the all-too-frequent death sentences of the old days. In the town of Captain Cook, they stopped at a farmer's cooperative to watch the processing of macadamia nuts and pick up a few gifts to take home. Never once had the words Torkel, Magnus, Toes, or Ring come up. On the way back, at Gideon's urging, they stopped in Kona to visit a place that even John didn't know about. A lovingly restored Hawaiian compound on a grassy tongue of land on the grounds of the King Kamehameha Hotel. From an anthropological point of view, Gideon told them, this was perhaps the most important site in Hawaii, the Ahuena Heiau, where the kind of event beloved of anthropologists had taken place over a century earlier. That rarest of occasions on which an entire society had changed literally overnight. It was here, in the largest and most impressive of the thatched structures, that Liholiho, son of Kamehameha, had sat down to dine in the company of women, thereby turning convention on its head and ending with one stroke a long-standing, strictly enforced taboo, and eventually, totally changing the relationship of men and women in Hawaii. Gideon wandered about, enchanted. This would have been the lele, where subjects left gifts.
Look, this must have been the Oracle Tower. This must have been.
Julie and John trailed patiently along among the buildings and carved statues, making respectful noises until Gideon had his fill. At a little before one, they were leaving the hotel's parking lot, looking for a likely place to have lunch, when John, sprawled sideways in the Taurus's back seat and reading something that he'd brought along with him from the ranch, let out a yell.
What?
He sat straight up and excitedly read aloud from the sheets of paper in his hand.
Among the interesting circumstances associated with them was the presence of a cartridge case partially embedded in the intervertebral fibrocartilage separating T8 and...
He shook the papers and practically moaned.
Doc, how could you not tell me about this?
John, what are you talking about? Is that the autopsy report? How'd you get it? I thought we weren't supposed to...
This is a copy that clerk made. Sarah, she gave it to us, remember?
And you've had it ever since?
Yeah. Why didn't you tell me about the cartridge case?
The case?
He barely remembered reading about it.
It didn't seem important. Micklejohn thought it was just some kind of freak accident. I didn't want to bore you.
Okay, never mind. Let's get back on the highway. We gotta go see Fukida.
I thought you were all done.
So did I, but I was wrong.
Do we have to go right this minute? Julie said. I was just thinking that Greek restaurant up on the corner with the outside balcony tables looks very appealing.
Forget lunch, will you? We can eat later. We gotta go to the CIS.
Forget lunch, Gideon murmured. We can eat later? This must be serious.
You got that right, John said.